Hi, everybody. We'll get started here in just a second. Jason, do you think we should go ahead and get started?
Yeah, I think that we're ready to go.
Exactly. Got over 20 people signed in. So, okay, hi, everybody. This is Brian Tierney from ESNet. And Kevin Thompson asked us to give a couple webinars on the role of Personar in the Science D&Z environment, thinking that most of you folks at least understand the importance of Science DMZs, but possibly the exact importance of having a Personar node in the Science DMZ may be less clear. So Jason Thurowski has offered to help us out with this, and I guess take it away, Jason.
All right. Well, thank you, Brian. And a reminder to everybody, just please keep your end muted, and I will try to speak clearly, and the slides are available on the web interface. We are recording this meeting, and we will make it available online after the fact. So this is really meant to be an introduction to Personar, and for the most part, we're not going to go into too much technical detail, but we will go into a little bit of insight into how this works on a network, and how it works in concert with other things such as the Science DMZ and data transfer nodes and advanced applications like Globus Online. So this will be the first real step of the webinar process. We will probably offer future webinars that discuss more in-depth technical things such as how to actually install and use a lot of this software. And we would ask that if you have questions, please use the web interface to symbolically raise your hand, and then Brian will be able to address your question, and then we can have a discussion at the end as well. So really what we're going to be going over today is a little bit of introduction and purpose to a couple of these different technologies, starting off with a little bit about why performance matters, some insight into the Science DMZ, and then we're going to move into more persona-related topics, including the different technologies that are available, and what a hardware-based deployment really looks like on your campus. So as Brian originally stated, the original purpose of this was to address the needs of the CCNIE program. And I am going to ask that everybody please do mute if you're not speaking. The campus cyber infrastructure, network infrastructure, and engineering program was meant to really upgrade a lot of the campuses to meet the challenges of the scientific innovation that's going to be required over the next couple of years. And I've highlighted a couple things directly from this solicitation, and three of them, performance, reliability, and predictability, are all very vital for scientific applications and distributed research projects. And this really hits to the core of why you need to have an infrastructure such as one that supports a Science DMZ-like technology or the use of virtual circuits provided by any number of different technologies, but most importantly, having performance and monitoring data available so that you can judge how well your network is performing over time and hopefully be nimble enough to address any problems that do come up. So really what we're going to be presenting is Personar, and what Personar is a federated end-to-end monitoring solution. And it won't be a very technical deep dive, but we will go into a little bit of detail why it's important and how it can be implemented. So I think that a lot of these requirements are well known by this community, but if they aren't, here's a way to just state them rather simply. Most scientific endeavors really do revolve around this concept of big data. And we've highlighted a couple here just as examples. Genomics in particular is one area that's going to be going through an astronomic increase in the amount of available data. And this is a sort of a collaboration, a sort of medium that wasn't always dependent on the network, but as the data amounts got larger and larger to the point where you couldn't carry a single run on a genomic sequencer on a portable piece of storage like a DVD, a CD, or a USB key anymore, they started needing to turn to the network. And because of this, their growth is going to be rather large right off the bat as they hook up some of the new devices and they need a way to process and handle the storage requirements. Coupled with the fact that the technology itself is decreasing over the time period as well. So we have cheaper technology and larger data being produced, which is really sort of the perfect storm as illustrated by that picture of needing to be able to support these different things. The requirements for other scientific endeavors are pretty well known. High energy physics continues to be a huge user of the network, and the data rates will increase over time, even though they are rather high at the current date. And we also have a lot of new science that's being developed in the form of light sources and other different endeavors, such as telescopes and things like that. So all of these different things are really combining into this common thread of needing this increased capability, but also a data mobility sort of requirement that means that their collaboration space is getting more and more distributed. And as your collaboration space is distributed, your people are distributed, your instrumentation is, all of this points to needing to use the network a lot more. So everything is becoming more and more global, and because of this, we need to have the support in terms of campus, regional, backbone, and international networking to support this. So this is a little growth chart that I grabbed from an ESNet report, and it shows what we're basically looking at in terms of projected use of the network. And it's a very, very nice curve, as you can see, and the reality sort of matches this with little ebbs and flows all along the path there. But the amount of science data that's traversing ESNet and Internet2 and regional networks is certainly, we're able to point to that and say that it is increasing. So we come to this next slide, which discusses, you know, being prepared for these different things. And there's a very good John Postel quote that I use there. In any large system, there is always something broken. And anytime we encounter a very large and very complicated system, you need to have technology and infrastructure in place to sort of deal with any of these complexities and failures that may arise. And we can point to some of these different situations. With the CCNIE program, we're encouraging people to upgrade their network technology, either by adding new devices or increasing the capability of existing ones. And it's an old adage that anytime you really start to get in there and mess with a working configuration, you're going to end up altering its behavior and perhaps for the worse in some manner. So upgrading networks does have a tendency to break them occasionally. And we also have worries about the synergy between old technologies and new technologies. These are not things that can really be shaken out through interoperability testing. You really start to see a lot of these problems when you have them implemented directly. And we also have a lot of new use cases and users that are coming into the network. So all of these things really coming together does put a lot of risk into how the network is designed and how it's operated. So we do need to have a couple of different things available to really mitigate this risk. We need to have an analysis and alteration done to the architecture itself, which plays to the idea of the science DMZ. We do need to carefully think about what security and data policies work and operate in this new environment. It may be the case that you need to go back and rethink any of the old documents that your campus may have prepared in this regard, because there aren't a lot of new threats and risks that you need to think about if you implement a new architecture. And lastly, trying to integrate the different pieces of software into this network. And one example of this is to have alerts and visualizations available so that you can start to be proactive about trying to monitor its health. So the next couple of slides are just going to go into a little bit of detail about the science DMZ. This is by far not a very in-depth examination, and future webinars may deal with the science DMZ architecture in more depth. So we have a lot of examples from the ESNet experience that talk about these different scientific communities and how their multiple data scales and requirements have really grown over the years. And as a part of going through and talking to these different communities and trying to document the process, we discovered that there is a significant bit that's really common amongst all these different interactions. And these can be lumped into a couple of different categories. In particular, we've noticed that undertuned and underpowered hosts used directly by the researchers is one area that really needs to be addressed. There's almost always some form of packet loss encountered in the local environment, or in some cases, the regional and backbone environment. And then there's also the insertion of security devices that aren't necessarily concerned with the overall performance of a system like this. So all of these things together really were the basis for this design paradigm, which we've termed the Science DMZ. And this is not necessarily a new concept. The same model is used successfully by a lot of different virtual organizations, campuses, research networks around the world. But this was really the first attempt to try to get all this information together and form it into a nice cohesive unit that can be implemented rather simply by the different people who are interested in really addressing the performance needs of science. It is a blueprint for network design, and that's something that we like to stress several times. The cartoons that we'll kind of show today are examples of this blueprint, but overall, it's not something that you can just point to and say, implement it in this exact manner, and it'll work for everybody. There's a lot of nuances and things that need to be considered on a per-campus and per-network basis, and we do encourage open discussion about this, and we'll point to some mailing lists later on in the presentation where people can go for additional help on this. This is one example of why the actual performance of a network really does matter. And this graph is sort of illustrating the performance over time when we have a very, very minuscule amount of packet loss, in this case 0.0046%, versus the different congestion algorithms and applications that would be able to utilize this network when it was clean and when it was dirty. And if we look at that top purple line right there, this is where we have no packet loss. And as the distance from the source and the sink grows, you're going to see a minor degradation in performance because the latency is getting harder or longer, and that makes the algorithms themselves have to work a little bit harder to get things done. But if we look at the bottom three examples there, the red, the blue, and the green lines, we can see that performance just goes automatically into the cellar there as soon as we get a little bit further away. So this is sort of illustrating that if you have any little piece of your network that's not functioning efficiently, you're going to run into situations where your users will have an instant and noticeable observation that things are not working as well as they should. So the Science DMZ, in more or less than one slide, is that there are three components to getting this to work properly. And the first is pretty much the most important and is sort of illustrated by that example that we had earlier. We need to have a friction-free network path. And a friction-free path basically means that all the pieces need to be working very well together so that they don't impact what the user is attempting to do on the network. The first part of this is having highly capable network devices, and that means having the latest in technology, having the queues configured properly so that there's no bottlenecks implemented in the network in that way. Having the ability to do virtual circuits, whether that be through a system such as OSCRS or even some of the emerging work in SDN, having this option available does simplify the data transfer requirements, especially if you've targeted other locations where you're going to need to exchange information with. Another equally important thing is having a security policy and enforcement that's specific to a scientific workflow. And we'll go into detail about this later, but what it basically means is you can't have a blanket security policy implemented by something like a firewall or a packet shaper in the path of a lot of this scientific innovation. And these devices do have a place. They have a place within the enterprise environment where you're not able to really know a priori what the requirements are for people exchanging information and sharing things between each other. They do not have a place in the scientific workflow because the scientific workflow, you can actually identify who you're going to be exchanging information with, what the level of security needs to be for the users and the data, and then try to craft a policy that doesn't involve a blanket device like that. It can be implemented in other ways, such as router ACLs or host-based firewalls, any number of other solutions that are not impacting on the network performance. And lastly, being able to locate this near the site perimeter definitely simplifies the implementation of the friction-free aspect of this. If you don't have it going through the campus core where there's a lot of congestion from other users, it's going to simplify the science application's ability to do its work, and equally, it's going to make it easier to support this within the core of the network itself. The second of these three components is the ability to use a high-performance data transfer device, and we've termed this a data transfer node. And what this really means is it's a very specially tuned piece of hardware and software and libraries and applications that are all optimized for data transfer. It's not a general-purpose machine. It can really be treated sort of as the gateway to pull the science data in or to expose it to the outside world. And from that little step, it can then be pushed further into campus where the people are actually going to be sitting and doing the information that they need to do in terms of processing and analysis. And then lastly, the piece that we'll focus on today is Personar, which is a performance measurement and test node. And all of this is detailed on the website, which is available at that link right there. So this is an abstract cartoon that a lot of people may be familiar with if you've ever looked at the website, but it sort of illustrates the different planks and how it can be implemented on campus. First and foremost, the biggest architectural split you'll notice is the identification of something that's going to be more at home in the enterprise world, which does have all those different protections available, versus something that's going to be more research intensive or science intensive and needs to be split out from that level of protection. Now, one thing that we do want to point out is that the science DMZ is not a lack of security. There is still lots of security that needs to be implemented there, and in many cases it needs to be thought about a lot more carefully than if you were to put this in the enterprise world. If you're going to be doing any form of securing of these devices when they live in an exposed environment such as the Science DMZ, you need to think about this in terms of per-service implementation and have policies that sort of match what the user and data representations of these security things really need to be. So that's illustrated right there on top of that Science DMZ switch and router. We also have our little diagram that shows where the DTN lives, the Personar node, and we've illustrated where the clean high bandwidth path resides versus where the inter-site connectivity would be. So the Science DMZ does take many forms, and because of this, it really depends on what you want to do and in how it's going to be implemented. You know, you could be a very small institution and have a project or two that need access to this, and because of that, the implementation may be very simple. If you're a facility inside of a larger institution, you have other things that you may need to consider, such as if there are other layers of firewall that you're going to have to pass through. All of these things should be weighed very carefully with the administration and the technical staff to figure out what makes sense. And if something needs to be protected more than something else, there are ways that this can be done. Some of these models are very straightforward. Others are less obvious. The DMZ model should be used to support research at its core, and because of that, the network is both the environment and the subject of research. We have a lot of examples of how this has been implemented, and a lot of them are still listed on the website. We're going to be soliciting members of the community, including the CCNIE participants in the coming months, to help us with this documentation process. So if anybody is interested in sharing what their network design looks like, I would encourage you to send us an email offline. So this is an example of another implementation technique here, and I believe it was Joe Breen at the University of Utah who pointed this out, but he said that after implementing the Science DMZ and then encouraging people to actually go out and use it, that removes it from the non-production sort of environment and pushes it into production, and because of that, it's harder to make changes and experiment with new and exciting things. So this sort of design shows how you can sort of have your cake and eat it too, where you have a production side where you have things stabilized and it works well with the existing users that have been migrated over there, but you still have a sort of research science DMZ that lives off to the side where you can make changes and implement different things. This is another derivation of that basic idea, but it shows where SDN sort of fits in. And with this model, that blue line there without the arrowhead sort of indicates a direct SDN connection. You can imagine this being sort of like the AL2S service that Internet 2 is offering. This can be something that's plunked directly into the Science DMZ portion of your infrastructure. It's not available to the general purpose Internet. and it can sort of be pushed off to the side, and you can experiment with it a little bit more until you're comfortable with how it operates. And then eventually maybe it does get migrated onto the border router, and then it's available to a wider selection of people. But this is one example of how it can be phased in lightly. So all of this really goes to the end game, which is trying to enable data-intensive science. And we have an example here of why using the right tool is extremely important to this overall process. So we set up a very small test bed between Berkeley and Argonne, Illinois. And the actual network setup is listed right there. It's about a 50 millisecond path, and the overall network capacity is listed at about 10 gigabits per second. Using the different tools that are available, starting with a tool that's probably available on everybody's operating system right now, the SCP tool, you can go all the way up to a very highly dedicated machine that's running something like Grid FTP with multiple streams, and you can see that different applications certainly have different ways of moving this information end-to-end. And this is just as important as the architectural and performance monitoring aspects. It's using the right tool for the job. We have been attempting to encourage people to not use SCP and to try to migrate into these newer and more capable tools. And a lot of scientific VOs are starting to hear that call, and they're making changes to their workflows to sort of support this. And along those lines, this is a slide that was provided to us by the Globus Online group. Globus Online is a set of tools that sort of tries to simplify the job of moving data. And it's done by installing some very simple software onto a machine within your home environment, which then adds it to this cloud of Globus services, and it allows you to get to other locations that have also enabled this. We're going to be working with the Globus Online community to also hold another webinar in coming months that would really address this specific need. So we would encourage you, if you're interested in learning about this, we'll send out announcements and you can attend that special webinar as well. So one motivation for the Science DMZ model is trying to eliminate the idea of these soft network failures. And a soft network failure is very contrastable to something like a hard failure where you would have a complete loss of service, and it's rather easy to detect. A soft failure is something that just sort of makes connectivity unpleasant. It's going to reduce the overall throughput or the overall experience for the network user, and it may end up being hidden from a lot of other users depending on where their vantage point is. For example, if you're very close to this soft failure and you're experiencing packet loss, you may not notice this at all. The further that you get away, let's say you're no longer within the original domain that has this packet loss, you're going to start to notice this problem a lot more. And this does bring into a lot of questions about how a protocol such as TCP could allow this. But if we look at the wording of the original RFC, TCP is intentionally designed to hide a lot of these errors from the user. As long as TCP continues to function properly, this extra feedback probably isn't going to make it back to the application layer, and thus makes it a lot harder to isolate where the packet loss and the degradation in performance really lives. So that's why we need to have a toolkit like Persona available to help us locate where these problems may exist and try to rectify them so that the users aren't the ones who are finding them. So this is another sort of expectation versus reality slide. If we look at the time it takes to copy 1 terabyte of information with different speeds of networks, in today's day and age, using a 10 gigabit per second network, you should be able to accomplish this feat in about 20 minutes, as long as you have fast disks, file systems, and properly tuned hosts at your disposal. And many scientific VOs are capable of doing this right now. As we go further and further down the stack, even 1 gigabit per second networks can still accomplish this feat within the span of a couple of hours. But if you have any form of performance problem that's really knocking down your ability to do this via packet loss or anything like that, you're going to be looking at taking days, or if not multiple days and weeks, to try to accomplish this goal. And this is a common problem for many people right now. We still have issues where a little bit of packet loss can be severely impacting the scientific process. We can also compare this to the more portable methods of data transfer that a lot of people still use, and you know, they may even still be calling it sneakernet. For the most part, you're still looking at a peak that's limited to under the speeds of a 1 gigabit per second network, which really points out that the different virtual organizations, especially those that are related to genomics and the emerging life sciences fields, they're starting to move away from that and go onto the faster networks because they know that it's going to allow their innovation to increase. So this is a little graph that tries to illustrate where the different problems may be located on an end-to-end path. If we look at the source campus there, we may have issues where we have a congested interdomain link. As we get further and further away, we see that the problems could be between the regional network and the backbone, or perhaps on the backbone themselves. And then at the destination, latency-dependent problems within the RTT as well. So if we just sort of draw a Venn diagram over this, we can see that performance is normally good or is perceived to be good when the RTT is very small. As long as you're not dealing with giant amounts of latency, your users will probably not see the problems of packet loss, or they won't complain about it. It'll be within their realm of, this is probably working good enough for me. As we get further and further away, performance is going to be poor and very, very noticeable. And this is why we need to have some form of inter-domain solution available so that we can measure these different factors and try to shake them out before the users do. So this is a little graphical example of what the data from a Personar node can tell you. In this case, we have some regular tests that are set up between two example nodes, one located at Oklahoma and the other located at the University of Michigan. And both sites had regular monitoring in place so that they didn't have to go and look at the picture all the time. They can plug this information into something like Nagios or Xenos and get in a little alert that says, hey, your performance has dropped. You might want to go and look at it. And this is really how a lot of operations groups are starting to migrate their way of doing things. They don't want it to be trouble ticket respond based anymore. They want it to be based on the fact that there are regular tests going on out there and the observations can be fed back to them in a method that sort of fits with their operational mentality. There's a couple of other examples we'll illustrate here. The one on the top left was an instance where the router had a full route table, and because of that, performance was being degraded for all traffic that was going through. As soon as the router was rebooted, magically things responded back up to their expected values of about 900 megabits per second. On the bottom right, we have a gradual failure of a line card. And hardware is not infallible. It will fail from time to time, but having a solution in place like this will try to grab these instances before they become a real problem for people. And as in this example, you can sort of see it goes from about April 5th to about May 2nd, so almost a full month before somebody realized that, yes, this was truly related to a failing piece of machinery that needed to be replaced. Here's another example that shows the value of latency data, and this is rather complex. This is a campus that was located in China doing tests to the campus at the University of Michigan. And we see two problems being illustrated in this data. The first problem is that we have a little bit of a time skew via NTP, but that's not the actual problem we're looking to fix here. The problem we're looking to fix is that during busy spots of the day, congestion got so great that it was actually pushing out the measurement traffic. And that's really what these tools are designed to do. They're designed to tell you when things such as congestion or non-congested packet loss are becoming a bit of an issue. So we can see during those busy spots of the day, we see a lot of packet loss, up to about 20%. So you have to imagine that, yes, our measurement tools are seeing this loss, but the actual users are experiencing it a lot more. And the last example we have is a very noisy link that needed to have a new attenuator attached to it. And we can kind of see the before and after there, which is sort of demarcated there in the middle. And that reduced a lot of the background packet loss that was being seen. So the next couple of slides are going to go into some examples of what performance looks like in typical campus environments, and these are based on true examples. This first one was an example of the Brown University campus, which did have a border firewall that was sort of impacting the scientific process. And if we look on the far left-hand side, we see that there is a Personar node set up there, and that is representative of where the scientists are physically located on the campus. On the lower right, there's another Personar node that's outside of that perimeter firewall. And then we have our uplink connection to the Internet 2 network via the Ocean Regional Network on the far right as well. So if we look at the data that comes from the Personar node that was behind the firewall, It's able to tell us two things. It's able to say tell us that that blue line that we're seeing, which is labeled as being source to destination, which is the brown network sending to a remote host, so going out through the firewall, that was not really being impacted too much. We're able to get pretty high performance in the 900 or so range with some obvious dips for congestion or other factors on the network. The green line, which was the remote campus, in this case it's Colorado, sending inbound to the brown campus, that was the one that showed a lot of problems, and it was limited to the 50 megabit or so range. We can then compare this with the Personar node that was put outside of the campus firewall, and we see that both directions are meeting expectations. They're pretty much 900 megabits or so, both directions, and we only see the occasional dip due to congestion or other factors on the campus. So in this case, it was a powerful motivator to figure out that, yes, this security device was impacting regular traffic, and it did facilitate the change in architecture to allow that to be removed. So the next couple of slides are going to go into a little bit more detail about Personar itself. So what we've kind of discussed so far is that everything we've seen, the diagrams and some of these examples, has sort of revolved around having this Personar node available to sort of tell us what's going on in the network. And the reason for this is that if you want to have consistent and reliable behavior, you certainly need to have correct behavior. And what Personar does is that it allows you to address this issue. You can't fix what you can't find, and you can't find what you can't see. Personar really helps you see what's going on within a network, as well as end-to-end to other locations around the country and the world. And we have to think about this in terms of what's it going to be good for current operational needs, but also how is it going to affect things into the future. And as we think about something like SDN, if there's a problem with the SDN infrastructure, you know, we certainly want to make sure that we fix that before it becomes production. And with all new technologies, SDN may be blamed a little bit more in the beginning because it is new and we're getting used to it. Having an infrastructure like Personar available goes to this need. It does try to figure out what's going on with the network without having to worry about how it's physically implemented in terms of technology. So what it is and what we've been talking about is that it's a form of network monitoring. And I think that everybody here probably knows that they have some form of internal network monitoring that's going on your campus right now. It could be something like SNMP, which is doing passive network measurements over the different devices in your path. It could be something like Nagios, which is the job of that tool is to try to monitor hosts and other factors such as that. Normally what we see is that monitoring is designed to help the local staff, and that's really what it's designed to do. It's meant to make the job of operations a lot easier by constantly monitoring over these things, sending you an alert if something happens to go down. But what we're running into, and to address one of the earlier points that I said in the slides, most scientific innovation is not done. Oops, I'm sorry. I just advanced way too far. Most of the scientific innovation is not done within the campus itself. It's done with collaborators that are located remotely, and you need to have access to their networks to be successful. So we need to have a migration of these tools from being just centered on local needs to caring about what an end-to-end and a multi-domain path really, really looks like. We also need to care a little bit more about active measurements versus just the passive measurements that we may be getting from some of our devices. If we think about what a user wants to do on the network, they probably have a couple requirements. If they're doing something like a video conference, they're going to want to have a very stable connection that doesn't have a lot of jitter and it has a very stable latency. If they're doing something like bulk data movement, they want raw performance and the ability to move a lot of bandwidth. A lot of the tools that are featured in the Personar package sort of emulate these different activities. They emulate what a large-scale data transfer would look like, or they're simulating what a video conference requires in terms of needing low jitter. So these different metrics sort of address what the needs of the users are, and they do help address those different things. So we also sort of couple this with we want to know what performance looks like over time. We just don't want a single point in time as a diagnostic measurement. We want to look at what it looks like over the past day, week, year, to all these different multiple endpoints. So these are all the reasons why we have this sort of measurement middleware at our disposal. So what is Personar? It's a tool that's meant to set network performance expectations, find these network problems, including these soft failures, and help fix the problems as it finds them. And it was designed by default to work in a multi-domain sort of environment, although it is perfectly comfortable working well within a local environment as well. Personar provides a standard way to publish and share this information. It really is the middleware that tries to unify the goals of a lot of these local tools that will be on the campus environment so that you can share this information in a safe manner and allow people who need to use your network to see what's actually going on. So this is just a snapshot of the worldwide deployment as of earlier this month. The individual locations are not as important as the fact that it is widely deployed within Europe, the United States, and it's emerging within South America, Asia, and the other Pacific regions there. A lot of people have certainly bought into this technology, and we do encourage those on the call who have not done so to really consider doing it as well. So the software itself is an open source implementation of the protocols, and the version that we're going to be talking about in particular is Personar PS. The URL is available there. All the products are available as RPMs, and we do support CentOS versions 5 and 6 for i386 and 64-bit architectures. It has been known to work on other implementations of Linux that are related to the Red Hat derivatives. We do not offer explicit support for this. The other portion of this, beyond just the RPMs, is the actual software package, which is called the Personar Performance Toolkit. And this is an ISO image that can be downloaded and burned to a CD, a DVD, or a USB key, and then installed to a server of your choosing. This can be done in one of two ways. It can function as a live CD where it doesn't destroy the local hard drive or try to store any data, or it can be used to totally dedicate that server to the purpose of performance measurement and monitoring. And once this software is installed, you sort of have this little command-like interface here that gives you an idea of what's going on your own network. You're able to configure these different components to do regular testing. You're able to advertise this so that other people can test to you. In terms of the metrics that are collected, there's a couple of different things that we like to emphasize that we think are important. It's not to say that in the future there will not be more metrics included, but these are the ones that are supported right now. In particular, we're pretty sure that packet loss, duplication, and out-of-orderness all at the transport layer is probably one of the most important things that you can do if we're attempting to eliminate this packet loss that we find on a lot of campuses. So having this installed and done as a regular test is usually the best way to try to get a very early indication of what your network is capable of or not capable of. The second sort of feature is the ability to test achievable bandwidth. And what we mean by that is what any application would be able to get at that point in time in terms of a bandwidth measurement. This doesn't measure full utilization or full capacity of that link. It just measures what, at that given point in time, that application would be able to do. And then we also have some others there, including latency, both round-trip and one-way, jitter, which is the delay variation, and then some of the more passive measurements, including interface utilization, discards and errors, route feedback, MTU, things like that. So all of this is all well and good, but how do you sort of integrate it so that it's useful for your operational team? And this is really what a lot of the very serious people are starting to do. They're starting to integrate this into a visualization package. And this is our example. It's called Mad Dash, and it's a brand new piece of the Personar toolkit that was just released earlier this month. And what this does is it tries to collect the measurements from several different Personar nodes, if they're all testing to each other, and visualize them in a nice, pleasing way so that you can see what's going on your network. And in this example, this is the version that's deployed at ESnet, and you can see that we have, you know, pretty much nice green, things are looking okay everywhere between these. And then we have a couple of locations where there's throughput limited to a lower range, and then we have some spots where we're unable to retrieve data. what you do with this information is you can, of course, look at it on a daily basis or a weekly basis, but we've also plugged this into a reporting mechanism through Nagios. And what that does is whenever there's an outage of some sort, somebody's going to get an email. And what they do with it is their choice, but odds are they're going to have to go out and try to fix whatever problem that is. So this has greatly helped identify where problems may crop up on the network, and it's fixed several of them. Some of the examples I showed earlier of those graphs are related to problems that were found via this infrastructure. So in terms of the United States deployment on the backbone networks, Internet2 and ESNet both maintain measurement servers that are located at all of their points of presence. You can see the links right there if you want to go and visit them. You can see what the results of the regular testing are between the members of these different meshes. And there also are two assistance lines available there. If you think that you're running into trouble with your network, you can certainly send an email to one of those links and somebody will try to assist you with debugging. This is a partial snapshot of the regional networks that I know to support PerfSonar. If you are a representative of one of these networks and I have your information wrong, just shoot me an email and we'll certainly correct it. But for the most part, we found that most regional networks do have a PerfSonar node of some sort available, and many are actually planning a larger deployment to support their campuses into the future. We can look to examples such as CanREN, who has a very full deployment, as well as LONI, and this was done to actually support a lot of the CCNIE activities that many of you are participating in. So if you don't know that your regional network has one of these things, you may want to shoot them an email and ask if they plan to in the future. So we're going to go into a little bit of detail about the actual hardware and deployment options now. The most critical thing is that you want to deploy these servers in a location where they're going to do the best good. And you have to think about in terms of what you're looking to find. For example, if you're going to put this outside of your network, outside of all the protection and stuff like that, and then test to somebody else's instance that is also outside of their network protections, you're probably always going to get green results. Everything is going to look very well because the network is well-provisioned and well-maintained between those two demarcation points. Ideally, you want to put PerfSonar nodes where people are going to be residing and doing work so that you can pick out where they're going to be having trouble versus allowing them to tell you when they're having trouble. So, for example, if you have a high-performance computing center or a very busy lab where there's a lot of researchers and grad students and scientists that are constantly doing work, it may make sense to put a PerfSonar node there. Now, who are you going to test against? This is a question where you're going to need to start reaching out to your users and figuring out where their information is traveling. You can use a tool like NetFlow or SFlow to help with that analysis process, but that will start to identify where the different patterns of communication are going, and it will help you identify where you should set up end-to-end tests with PerfSonar. So here's a quick little diagram that shows where these machines would do the best sort of good for your network. And they're located in several spots around the network here. But if you do have one outside of your site border, outside of the firewall, you certainly want to make sure that you also have one within the firewall, especially if it represents a path that your users are going to be taking. That could be where the storage lives. It could be where the compute cluster lives. It should be something that has to travel over all the infrastructure that those users are going to be using for it to do the most good. And then you can set up tests to an instance at ESNet, Internet2, or remote campuses that happen to support this as well. So the importance of regular testing is really that you can't really rely on things to work 100% at all times. Things break. It's just a way of life. Failing optics, somebody may have fat-fingered a patch for a kernel. You may have a kinked fiber. Hardware may just be going bad. There's many different things that can just happen in the network, and having this infrastructure in place will certainly address those different things. Having this regular testing in place gives you a record. It gives you a record of what performance looked like a week ago versus a month ago versus a year ago, and it will help you identify quickly if something doesn't look right. So to do this, we do encourage people to try to develop a plan, and this goes into thinking about what makes the most sense to do in terms of the measurements you want, the locations where you need to get this information from, and how it's going to affect your different user communities. So if you're thinking about doing bandwidth testing, you probably want to identify a couple of regional destinations as well as collaborators and try to set up regular tests a couple of times a day. That gives you multiple data points to look at so that you can identify busy and slow periods of the network, and it also allows you to see the patterns that may start to develop. Loss and availability and latency are very similar. You can actually get away with configuring a lot more of these types of tests than you would with the bandwidth because it's less resource intensive. We would encourage you to test many places with your OAMP installations if you have the ability to do so. And then once you have this information, you plug it into a system such as Nagios or a website or a MADDASH-like implementation and allow other people to see it. It's important to advertise what your performance is, because if somebody's having a hard time reaching your campus, they're more inclined to go out and look for that result instead of, you know, suffering in silence. This is another example of a dashboard application that a virtual organization developed. This is from the Atlas Collaboration, which is a physics project, and they did this all independently of their individual campuses and regional operators. They basically were able to allocate money to get servers at each of these 9 locations, and then they set up tests between them, and then they developed their own software to sort of analyze and tell if things were working okay or if they weren't. So they're very serious about having networks that work well for their collaboration, and when something does happen to start to go wrong with their networks, they will go out and actively ask the regional, campus, and backbone providers for help in trying to debug these things. So they're extremely proactive. In terms of host considerations, we do have a web page there that details a little bit about hardware choice. We do recommend that if you're going to go this route, you should have dedicated persona hardware, and it should be server class. You can get away with using some of the smaller devices, whether it be a desktop computer, a laptop, or a mini, such as a Mac Mini or a Shuttle, but we've seen that these can be problematic for long-term use. They just don't have the architecture that a standard 1U, 2U server would have inside of it, and because of that, they introduce a little bit of error into the collected data. We also recommend that if you're going to use a dedicated Persona host and you're using the Persona toolkit software, it's already turned off a lot of the additional features of Linux that are not needed. You know, it's a dedicated machine that is focused on network monitoring. If you're going to try to install the RPMs and just make a machine based on something that you have running already, a lot of that background information can end up perturbing the results as well. We do recommend that you use a separate host for throughput and latency. The throughput tests are very heavyweight, and the latency tests are very lightweight. And if you try to run those both at the exact same time, you can end up perturbing the results between them. If you only have the ability to do one server, it is perfectly possible to run these two types of tests on the same machine. Just be aware of that as you're looking at the data. There are certain things that do only show up if you're using testers that are capable of going at 10 gigabits per second, but that's not to say that a 1 gigabit per second tester is still not a very valuable thing. We do recommend that people try to think about this carefully about what their network is going to look like.
Yeah.
And then lastly, we also have a little bit of a comment there about virtual machines. Virtual machines don't always work well as persona hosts, but there are specific use cases that can work out okay. We find that clock sync issues are the biggest issue. A virtual host just can't keep very good time versus one that's based on bare metal. And we also have seen that throughput is reduced significantly if you're using a virtualized host. So if you're going to go the VM route, it does work well for NDT, Nagios, SNMP, and 1 gig throughput testing, but it does not work very well for 10 gig testing and for latency and loss. So the last little bit of this is just discussing a common use case on how this would actually work in your local environment. And normally a lot of operations methodology is based on the fact that a trouble ticket is sent in and then somebody is able to act on it. And a lot of these trouble tickets may be rather simple. They may just say we're getting poor performance from one site to another site. So what we found is that if there are persona nodes at each site border, you're able to run tests between these and then determine if the performance is good or bad. And then you could run additional tests to things in the middle or to things that are deeper within the network and try to find where the packet loss is or is not. But to do this, you do need to have this available at the different sites, and that's often the hardest part. If a location doesn't have a persona node deployed, it does take time to get one out there. So by having this out there immediately, it does sort of simplify the task of debugging and takes time off the how long it will be in the process. So this is a couple of slides on WAN test methodology and how you can use it to isolate a problem. And to really do this, you need to think about how TCP works and how applications work in general. So if you're going to be doing a segment-by-segment investigation, which could be a very long process, it's unlikely to be helpful unless you think carefully about what you're looking to find. The TCP dynamics between each of these hops will certainly be very different. And problem links can test clean over a short distance, but if you're testing over a longer distance, like we saw a little bit earlier, it's harder to shake out where the problem may actually be. So what we attempt to do is we want to test the largest part of the path that we can and find it to be clean, and then we can try to isolate the problem from that point. And we have a couple of diagrams that sort of show this. So in this example, we had a problem between a national laboratory and a university campus there, and it's a very simplified diagram wherein we saw poor performance in one direction. So going from the national lab to the university, it was poor. The other direction, it didn't show that same problem. If we expand this diagram a little bit more and put in where the different domains are and the different metrics of these domains, we can start to see a little bit more of the problem. Within the local environments, both in the campus and the national lab, the latency between the edge and the device should be very, very small. It should be approximately 1 millisecond. If we look at the two long paths, which are related to the national networks, ESnet and Internet 2, they comprise 30 or so milliseconds or 15 or so milliseconds, and then we also have a regional network hop in there as well. So the take-home so far is that, yes, we have a lot of different components to this, but we also have a lot of different persona nodes available and can be used to our advantage. The story right now is that we're still seeing poor performance between those two performance nodes that are sort of in the top middle there. So if we test between the edge of the one national backbone to the edge of the one regional network, we're able to verify that it is clean and fast in both directions, and it is about a 50 millisecond path. So at this point, you know, you may not think that we've done a whole lot, but what we've been able to say is that with certainty, we know that it is a clean, fast path between those two different locations there, and that the problem itself is most likely isolated to one, the other, or both of those two local environments. We can then add in a couple of more testing steps here to verify what we're really seeing. If we go between the university's personar node to the edge of the national, to the ESnet network, we're able to see, again, that we do have a dirty and slow in one direction, clean and fast in the other. And if we do it to the border device, the other thing that's located on the university, we can sort of see the same thing. So what this is really pointing to at this point is that the problem is most likely within the university's network in a location where we would see it showing up where both of those nodes would go through it. So that sort of points to it being the connection between the regional or the university or something within the university itself. So this is how you can use these tools to sort of dissect and debug these different problems. You need to really spend a lot of time thinking carefully about what you're looking to find. Otherwise, you will spin your wheels a little bit in wasting time and testing things that are known to be good or known not to be the problem. So the testing can be done very quickly if persona is deployed, and this does allow you to be hugely productive. You do have to have reasonable hypotheses, and you do need to have the ability to do the testing time between these different things. Without having this available, it does make it very challenging, and the time to resolution can be measured in months instead of hours and days. And there are a lot of those problems that are out there, but having this infrastructure in place does simplify things. So I'm going to start to wrap up a little bit here, and then we'll go into a question period. There was lots of information presented today, including why performance matters, how to implement the network, and how to use the software to help guarantee it. I think the next couple of steps are that if you're already not subscribed to a lot of the mailing lists, and we'll have the links in a slide or two, make sure that you join in. We will probably be offering other webinars in the future related to Personar, Globus Online, and the Science DMZ, and we will certainly make those announcements via these mailing lists. These are the Performance Node mailing lists, and we do encourage you that if you're going to deploy this on your campus, you do have somebody sign up and listen to the conversation or ask questions if there's going to be problems. And this is the information on the Science DMZ mailing list. We also have several new forums that are available on the FASTR data site. We would encourage you to use either the mailing list or the forum to ask questions and get involved with this conversation. And lastly, a lot of this information is taken from the pages of FASTR data, and that's where a lot of this stuff is available, including TCP tuning, the construction of a data transfer node, and a lot of reference implementation. So we would encourage you to visit that as well. So with that, I think that I will end my talking phase, and we can go to questions. So Brian, were any questions asked during the presentation?
Yeah, we just had a couple questions come here at the end. The first one is, have you found a particular NMS that you feel Persona integrates or works with more seamlessly? Do you want to take that, Jason, or do you want me to try?
I think you can take that one since you're closer to the development than I am.
Okay. At least as far as we know, that we don't think that there's much out there in the commercial NMS space or even open source NMS space that even really does anything similar to Personar in terms of the ability to run active tests in the background continually in any reasonable way. Now, Personar does have an interface to the CACTI SNMP monitoring system, so it exports SNMP data in the standard Personar schema. And there have been some attempts to do visualization tools that sort of integrate that well with the other Personar data that has had mixed results so far. That's why they're not packaged as part of the toolkit. We still are looking for folks to help us with some more of the high-level visualization stuff. And you can feel free to unmute and talk, too, if you want, David. I wasn't sure exactly what you meant by the question. But yeah, as far as integration, it's just CACTI.
And I guess to add on to that, we also have plugins available for Nagios, and they work well with Xenos, I've been told. So, you know, the information can be consumed by a couple of different NMSs, I guess. It just comes down to, I guess, what your local staff is comfortable working with.
There was a question about, are we posting the slides? Jason, did you already post the slides after the last webinar? Are they already up there?
Yes, the slides are already up there from the last webinar. I will send out a reminder email to people where they'll be available, and we'll also post the link to the recording.
Right, okay. But yeah, they're linked off of the FASTR data science DMZ sections. So another question was around slide 41. You show a pathway through the firewall. Can you address what we do regarding firewalls when building the Science DMZ?
So I think this goes back to the original thing, which is if you're going to be designing a Science DMZ, the firewall probably should not be within that environment at all. The firewall should be on the enterprise side, protecting all the stuff you have no knowledge of. So all the BYOD, the HVAC systems, the IP phones, the printers, anything that you don't trust implicitly. Within the Science DMZ environment, it's kind of understood that you're going to talk to the people who are allowed to go into the DMZ. You're going to identify who they are, what their machines are, what their network paths are. And because of that, you can sort of identify, you know, what are their patterns and how are they, and who's going to be maintaining the security of their individual systems. So, you know, while this picture shows the firewall there, you could sort of imagine that while it's not pictured, there will be a Science DMZ, and it'll sort of be off of the site border versus behind the firewall.
Does that answer the question?
Well, if it doesn't answer the question, you can, of course, send me an email offline.
Okay, anybody else have any questions? Feel free to type them or just unmute temporarily.
Hi, folks. Brandon Burke from Hopkins. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. On a practical purpose, we haven't deployed actual persona software here yet. On a practical level, is it feasible to monitor, to use a single perf sonar server to monitor, say, multiple points on your network? If you were to, say, bring a couple of different VLANs, maybe with some Dyn's connectivity into the same box?
Say, for example, so it is feasible to do that. I think that the complication comes in if you're trying to dual home the perf sonar box or tri home it or quad home it. It doesn't really work well by default with that sort of setup, but it can be done. That's the sort of thing that you'd probably have to send us an email, and we can tell you how it's been known to work in the past. For the most part, these things are sort of designed to live in a single network, and the VLAN stuff does complicate things a little bit, but it is possible. So you can get away with a single node, but if you have the ability to do multiples, it may be easier to maintain in the long run.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, it's something that we've been thinking we should address. It's, you know, it's fundamentally just that the web GUI to configure everything doesn't support that mode, but it is definitely possible if you're enough of a Linux hacker can go in under the covers and make all that work. Question, can you say something about security when going around firewalls, special tools, or federation? I mean, definitely we advocate that you don't want to, if you don't have stuff behind the firewall, you got to make sure you're doing other types of best practice security, such as IDSs and syslogging and you know, standard things you should probably be doing anyway, but when there's not a firewall, you really, really should be doing it. I don't know, Jason, if you have anything to add on that.
I think what it comes down to, and a lot of people may have done this for their CCNIE proposal, is you need to do more or less a comprehensive cyber infrastructure plan for your campus. But one of the things that you need to really consider is things like user management and data management. This is the step of identifying if the researcher is doing something with private health information or social security numbers, something that needs protection, versus if they're just exchanging data value, time value pairs with each other, which is kind of what a lot of scientific data looks like. You know, if you don't have the software to analyze it, it's certainly not something that's a big secret. If we look at the physics world and the genomics world, a lot of that really is just that. It's just data and time, and then they have software that goes through and tries to analyze it. So if you can kind of pull out what the requirements of the data are versus how it's going to be used, that sort of simplifies the role of how you would create the security within the DMZ and against the DMZ. But as Brian said, it is more of a system-based approach. You have to care about things like an IDS and the individual policies on a per-service basis versus just some device that sits in the path and sort of handles that all for you.
Yeah, I mean, most security experts will tell you that, you know, firewalls often give folks a false sense of security, that there's not necessarily that much added value, particularly not add any added value to something like a DTN, because no firewall, commercial firewall, knows how to do deep packet inspection on a grid FTP stream or anything like that. Well, we're a few minutes over. Any last questions? Question is, why is this so different from Orion or Prime? And I don't know what Orion or Prime are, so I can't answer.
Yeah, I don't know those either. So, Lionel, if you want to send us an email, we can try to address that. Okay, well, I think that sounds like it's it. I will stop the recording. We will send an email to everybody where you can download this later on. So thank you, everybody, for joining.
Cool.
Okay, thanks everybody.
Thank you. Please stand by.